Buongiorno everybody and welcome to a new episode of ID Element, all about the launch of Uproof. This is the third video in a series and we are here with Stefan Brands, who is the principal architect behind the Uproof initiative. Hi Stefan, thank you for being with us again.
Hi Vittorio, good to see you again, welcome to my office.
Thank you, and just to prove that this is actually Stefan's office, I want you guys to appreciate the mega banner of Uproof that here shows that we are in the right place. And today we are featuring Stefan again on the Element because we would really like to take a deep dive in the details of Uproof. We heard so much about the good properties of Uproof and it sounds like magic. How does it manage to make in agreement the security requirements and the privacy requirements. And we'd really like to hear the details so that it's not magic, but it's just a very, very clever crypto, isn't it?
It's what we call crypto magic.
Fantastic. So, Stefan, it would be fantastic if you could find the time to lead us through a travel through all these so that we can actually understand how you achieve what Uproof achieves.
Excellent, it will be my pleasure. I can elaborate for hours. I'll try and keep it within an hour. Shall I start?
All right.
Okay then, so let me start with the conventional three-party model for the issuance and presentations of security tokens. It's a model that everybody who works in the identity field is very familiar with, and I'm going to not spend too much time on it, but I need to put these actors on there to set the stage for all the other stuff on Uproof. So we have the three usual parties, relying party, identity provider, and user, principal, subject, whatever you want to call it. In the identity ecosystem that we're building online today, right, the way things work is the user goes to a relying party, wants to gain access to a service or a resource. The relying party may say, you know, I need to know something about you before I can give you access to that service or resource. And I trust certain authoritative sources, like this one over here, with making those statements about you, so please show me a statement like that, right? So then the request for what the information is that the relying party wants to see is transferred to the user in a user-centric way, and then the user says, okay, I'm going to retrieve a security token that has that information in it from the identity provider. So user goes here, identity provider checks that this is really the right user, and then issues a token with whatever the appropriate information is, and for security, digitally signs it with its key, and then the user just forwards that to the relying party, and the relying party checks it, says, ah, that was indeed from the authoritative source, and it proves that you're over 18 or that you're Stefan Brands, whatever is stated in there, and then it will give you access to the service. Now, so this works really well for enterprise scenarios, extended enterprise scenarios, and what have you. So there are, however, some new requirements emerging when you look at the exact same model in more distributed environments where the relying party and the identity provider are different entities, and maybe the user is also an autonomous party, like a citizen or a consumer, right? So maybe accessing a merchant or a government website or what have you, a site online, a commercial site, and maybe on the basis of credential data that is issued by a bank, a government organization, etc., etc. Now, in these more distributed environments, there are a number of additional challenges that different parties, all of them in fact, may want to address. Let me get the pen here. I'm going to briefly mention four. The first is on-demand. This is what we call on-demand token retrieval. When you get access to a service, or want to gain access to a service, you have to, in real time, pull out a token with the right information. So those on-demand tokens, on-demand, they're not always suitable for distributed scenarios because the identity provider has to be available at all times. It has to be able to handle peak loads. If there's a denial of service attack over here, the user cannot access. This is the relying party. There's liability issues potentially involved with that. The other thing is that the identity provider learns where the user is going in order to prevent certain attacks. After all, it will need to encrypt the token for the relying party or put the relying party's identity in there so that the token can only be used at that relying party, right? If it doesn't do that, then the relying party could replay the token at another relying party, or maybe the user could transfer the token to a buddy, which may constitute a security issue in case that token actually is a privilege or an entitlement only for the user. The other thing is that the relying party and the user and the identity provider, they know exactly which user is going where. In fact, the identity provider, as I mentioned, sees that by default, but also the timing of the two events, just by matching the records, they see exactly which user went to what relying party at what time. And that may be an issue because of privacy of the user, maybe a concern for the relying party, could be competitive intelligence after all, it's maybe commercial customer data. So there's a privacy issue. The other thing on the privacy side is that this digital signature is a unique number that is added for integrity and source authenticity by this party, and it's seen by the relying party, and that's a globally unique number that will instantaneously allow the two parties to trace the transaction. So even if you only need to prove I'm over 18 according to this party, they'll know exactly who you are, right? So there's a privacy challenge that may need to be addressed. Now, the other thing is that these tokens, they're software-only tokens. It would be nice if you could actually issue these tokens to smart cars, trusted platform modules, or special devices so that, let's put a smart card there, right, so that the user cannot actually show the token to a relying party unless the smart card actually allows that token to be shown. For example, the smart card could say, hey, you know, I want to get your biometric before I release the token, which could ensure that the user cannot give his tokens to someone else. Or maybe the smart card could say, you know what, these tokens you should only be able to use at certain relying parties or only for certain uses. So basically, software-only tokens, it's hard to put use restrictions on them, very fine-grained ones. So, so it would be nice if we can have hardware-bound or protected tokens, which is a little bit problematic in today's with the conventional technology, because you would have to start issuing tokens to the user's smart card or what have you, and these are constrained devices that cannot do many operations. They're slow. There's all kinds of issues there. Now, let me just stay with those three challenges. Now, YouProof.
So can you actually write the third one, so otherwise we'll forget.
Okay, so I'm going to call those device.
Perfect.
Protected tokens. And those are useful to prevent users from transferring the tokens to others, as well as to enforce all kinds of use restrictions, such as you cannot use your token more than three times.
Perfect.
So conventional security token technologies, they're not designed to handle these kinds of requirements, and that's because these requirements don't exist in the traditional environments or scenarios such as enterprise scenarios. Now let me get to YouProof and how it addresses these and other requirements. There's actually 18 different properties that YouProof has been designed to address. The others are a little bit more esoteric, so probably we won't have time to get into these. Okay, I'm going to erase this. So, YouProof is a cryptographic technology. So at the heart of it is the notion of a new kind of security token in web services speak, right? So it's not a Kerberos ticket or an X509 certificate or what have you, any of these conventional security tokens, a SAML token. It looks a lot like some of these, but it uses advanced cryptographic techniques, both at issuing time and at presentation time. These are two separate protocols. Issuance and presentation are separate protocols. Before I go into the crypto, let me just explain the structure of YouProof token. So again, it's any kind of data, you know, name, age, citizenship or residency or what have you, right? Whatever the identity provider wants to put in there. And it's also digitally signed, by the identity provider for the user. Now, in addition, this is not new to those familiar with PKI certificate technology. There's also a key in there, a public key of the user. And this key, this public key, is generated by the user during the issuance of the UProof security token. It's lumped in there. We'll get later to that there's some special magic in how that's done. So that key corresponds, so it's a public key. I should write P public key. It's a user public key, and it's unique for each security token. The user knows a corresponding secret key that it never, that the user never divulges to anyone, right? So when the token is issued, whatever the claims are that go in there, because the user has a secret key that's bound to the token, it's it, the public key is part of it, what it can now do, and this is still fairly conventional security stuff, of course, is that when it presents the token with all of the contents and the signature of the issuer to the relying party over there, the relying party could say, you know, and this is to prevent a replay attack and certain other attacks, it could say, you know, in addition, I want you to prove that you know for the public key that's in there, and that's also that's signed along with the other attribute data by the identity provider, I want you to prove that you know the corresponding private key. So, which is done through standard crypto, it's channel's response, where the relying party generates a nonce, and it sends that to the user, and the user then applies the private key, and so the result is what we call a proof. It you can technically we can refer to it as that as a proof of knowledge. It's a proof of knowledge of the private key of the user that corresponds to the user's public key that was put in the token.
So that's like the proof token in classic WS Trust, but
yes.
You have an asymmetric system instead of a classic symmetric session.
Yes, exactly. So this a proof key is definitely a well-known concept. So nothing new so far, and you know the benefits of that are that this can prevent replay because the relying party, even if the token is a long-lived one, it's valid for a year until it expires in accordance with maybe an expiry date that's explicitly stated there. The relying party won't be able to turn around and show it to another relying party because it'll get another challenge from that other relying party. And without knowing the private key, it's impossible to compute the corresponding proof of knowledge, the response to the challenge. Now, where things start to get different is, first of all, it's a technique we call selective disclosure. And I'll later explain how that relates to these things here. It's not obvious at this point. Notice that in order for the relying party to verify the integrity and the source authenticity of this presented security token, it needs to be able to verify the digital signature of the identity provider. And with conventional digital signature technology, it means that whatever was digitally signed here, you need to present all of it. Otherwise, you cannot check with the public key of the issuer the signature. Now, somewhat amazingly or surprisingly, it's possible with the UProof technology for the user to hide any of the claims that are in there before presenting the token to the relying party without destroying the verifiability of the digital signature of the issuer. Now, let's get into some basic crypto to give you an idea of how this can be done, a naive approach, but it will show you that it's possible to do this. Does green work?
Let's give it a try.
Let's give it a try.
Yeah, look at that.
Yeah?
Yes.
Okay. I'm going to sit.
The emotion is too much, right?
Yeah.
You have to sit.
Well, it's also a bit low. So, okay, so in the standard approach, the issuer would say, okay, I have these attributes. Let's call them A1, A2, A3. And I have a user public key of user, and the whole thing I'm going to sign with an RSA or DSA signature or what have you. Now, to do the selective disclosure in a naive approach, what you can do is, in fact, that instead of signing these attributes explicitly, the issuer could say, you know what, I'm going to sign a hash function of A1, a hash function of A2, and a hash function of A3, and the public key. That's what I'm going to sign. So, and these are the attribute values. So now, a property of a hash function is that it hides the input. And in fact, if you want to do it in a better way, then in fact, a salt would be put into each of these, alpha 1, alpha 2, alpha 3. If not, then a simple brute force, if there are only a few values possible for each of the attribute values, a brute force will reveal what the input to the hash output was, right? So you can throw in a random number in each of these, hash of A1, comma alpha 1, etc. And you sign all of these. Now, when you present the token as the user, it still has your public key in there, everything goes as normal. So you divulge those hashed values, right? And those hashed values do not disclose any of the attribute values. So if, however, the relying party can still check the signature of the issuer, yes, these random values that make no sense to me, and oh, they've been hashed by the issuer, that they originate from the issuer. So public challenge response happens on the basis of public key. But in addition, the relying party could say, please open for me the second value, which may be your name. And this, right, these may be your gender and your residency, and you don't want to disclose those. You don't have to disclose those. So you would simply then say, here is A2, comma alpha 2. The inputs to the hash function, that's another property of hash functions, that collision-free hash functions, as we call them, that it's impossible for the user to know different inputs that map to the same hash output. You can only know one. So therefore, so you have no choice as a user, if you want to disclose that, than to disclose the actual attribute value that the issuer put in there, your name, for example. So this shows you how you can do, in a very simple way, a selective disclosure, a subset disclosure, any subset of the attribute values you could disclose while hiding unconditionally any of the other values that whose hashes you're not opening. Now there's a number of shortcomings of this I'm going to skip, because I'll jump into how uProof does it, because it addresses all of these shortcomings. Now what we basically building on this idea. So instead of taking SHA or whatever hash value you have, in cryptography we call this a commitment to the attribute values A1, A2, and A3 in this case. Because once they're in there, as I said, the user cannot change his mind. It's impossible to come up with other values later on that map to the same output. So this idea that we can sign, so we would put in a function more generally, which is a collision intractable function, cryptographic function, one-way function, of A1, A2, and A3, as well as the user's private key. That would go in there. Now, we're going to pick that function that will commit the user to the attribute values that the issuer is signing, and essentially the issuer, through this, it's encoding those attribute values into the security token, just indirectly. So this function is going to be a special one that will give the user very powerful capabilities to open up some of the attribute values, but also the proof properties. It will actually be possible for the user to say, you know, A1, which represents, let's say, my name, according to the issuer, instead of either hiding or disclosing it to the relying party, I can prove a property about it, such as my name is not equal to any of the following 10 names that may be on a blacklist of the relying party, without disclosing what the actual value is. So I can do much more complicated or fancy stuff than just hiding or opening each of these values. And there's some other benefits that we'll get into. Notice, so these tokens can be long-lived as well as on-demand. Nothing stops a relying party from saying, I want you to retrieve one of these tokens in real time. Much like PKI certificates, they can have a longer lifetime. And because because of this public key mechanism, right there, replay attacks are prevented. And then there are some additional techniques that will guard against other security problems that, that are introduced when you switch to long-lived security tokens. Does it make sense so far?
Absolutely. I'm really loving this. So, the signature that you are applying to everything, is it a traditional signature or you have your secret sauce there as well?
That's a very good question. So that signature is a new kind of cryptographic signature. And I'm going to push the explanation a little bit further down the line because the issuing protocol is a little bit more complicated. But I can tell you already right now that instead of the issuer getting the attributes and the user's public key for the token and then applying its signature scheme to produce the signature, it actually never sees its own signature. What will happen over here in this protocol, it's an interactive three-leg protocol where, in effect, the user and the issuer are jointly generating the issuer's signature. Or you can look at it in another way, that the user is in fact generating the signature of the issuer with a contribution of the issuer. Obviously, the user shouldn't be able to make his own signatures that look like they are the issuer's signature. But, you know, there's some magic happening there that will actually address the privacy concerns, in particular the linkability that otherwise would result on the basis of the issuer's signature.
All right.
So we're going to be able to ensure that the signature cannot serve as a correlation handle to trace the presentation of the token to its issuance. But first, selective disclosure, and we'll see how that also can help with non-transferability, apart from privacy benefits. Okay, so now we get into some crypto specifics.
I thought that we were already there, but...
Number theoretic cryptography as opposed to simple hashing.
Right.
Okay, so there's various cryptographic intractability assumptions that you can use to build the U-proof technology on. There's the factorization assumption that is at the heart of RSA. There's another one that we prefer, which is called the discrete logarithm problem. It's less known to the general public, but it's the one that's also at the heart of the digital signature algorithm. So the discrete logarithm problem, the DL problem, it's like a standard logarithm challenge. Basically, quickly giving you the setup, what we do is we're doing computations modulo a very large prime number. Let's call that prime number P. So very elementary number theory says, you know, if we look at the numbers 0, 1, all the way to P minus 1, this is a very large prime number, 1024 bits or more. If we look at all of these numbers, then they form a finite field, we call that. That means that you can pick any of the numbers in there, and you can multiply them with the modulo P, mod P operation. So I can pick a number A, and I can pick a number B, and then I compute that modulo the prime P. That's over there. What that means is that, let's say, as a toy example, if P is 11, and so I have the numbers 0 to 10. So if I take numbers 3 and 5, 3 times 5, mod 11, that's 15. And I'm going to subtract this number as many times as possible until I'm back in the interval between 0 and P minus 1. So in this case, it's 15 minus 11. So 3 times 5 mod 11 is 4. Right? So if I would do 7 times 5, which is 35, mod 11 is 2, right? Because I can subtract 3 times, I can subtract 3 times 11. So I bring it back to this interval. I'm basically looping around. Now, so we can do, the important thing to focus on is we actually don't care about this number here. We only care, in fact, about multiplications in this set here of numbers from 1 to p minus 1, everything computed modulo that prime P, that very large prime P. Now, let me get the... Now, there are some very magical properties that are standard elementary number theory. When you look at these numbers modulo P, they have different orders, which means if I look at a number like 2, and I'm going to look at 2, I'm going to then look at 2 times 2, at 2 times 2 times 2, etc. Right? I'm essentially going to raise it to different exponents, A. Well, I should call it E for exponent. So I'm going to look at 2 to the power 1, 2 to the power 2, 2 to the power 3, etc. I can look at that all the way up to 2 to the power p minus 1. It's obviously a huge set of numbers that we can never write down because it's in the order of 2 to the power 1024 numbers, which is like 100 to the power, what have you, some astronomical number, right? So basically, because I said if you look at any numbers and you multiply them, at mod p, you'll end up obviously in the same set again. So as you look at these consecutive numbers, you're cycling in some way through the numbers in this group here. So you start with 2, 4, 8. So if we look at a toy example of 11, then we get 16 mod 11, right? So that's 8. The next one is 5. 16 modulo 11 is 5, right? So in fact, the next one would be 2 to the power 5, and you can, that is actually 10. Sorry. 10. So, and we can keep going if you do the computations. So essentially, by looking at some number A to consecutive powers, we end up with some number B modulo P that is in that in that group. Now, the discrete logarithm problem says that, let me use the right terminology, symbols, that if we take a number g in between 1 and the prime minus 1, we pick one and we raise it to a random number, still exponent, right, modulo p, so we get some result, again between 1 and p minus 1, mod p, that if I pick that number randomly from this whole set, and this one I pick it randomly and secretly, that if I then give you the result of this computation, and prime is huge here, right? We're not talking about 11, that, and I ask you, you know, Vittorio, can you find out, I'm giving you G and H, which E did I use? So it turns out that there's no known method to compute E efficiently. There's some technicalities you need to satisfy to make that statement actually true, but it would, if you take a prime of 1024 bits, it would take you all the time in the universe and all the computing power that we have today for millions of years in order to actually figure out what particular random E I used to compute this. Now, so this discrete log problem, we can actually build our whole U-proof empire on this this intractability problem.
Nice.
So, now, so what we're going to do to make it slightly more technical, so we look at computations modulo P, so we look, right, we pick a large prime P, and this is what the identity provider will pick. I'm going to pick a very large prime number P. So that's the set of all the elements that we're going to be able to compute with modulo P. Now, instead of looking at arbitrary numbers G, we're actually going to look we're going to pick a prime, the issuer, the identity provider will pick a prime P that is of a form, P is, let's say, 2 times Q plus 1. So for example, if in a toy example, if P is 11, that's 2 times 5 plus 1. So there our Q would be 5. But the point is Q has to be another prime. So right. So if I pick, I'm going to start, and as I'm going to pick a prime number Q, 11. 11 times 2 is 22, plus 3 is 23. That happens to be a prime. So P comma Q equals 23 comma 11 will work for me. The important thing is I have to pick my prime P of a special form. And you can be a little bit more liberal, and in the toolkit, in the specification, we do that, in fact. So this is just to explain the idea. Now, as it turns out, so if we pick our P of that form, 2 times Q minus 1, then, you know, all of these P minus 1 numbers here, let's put them as little dots in there. There are 2 to the power 1024 in that order. It's like a huge group, right? So we pick one of these numbers. Well, if we look at the number 1, I look at this, the number 1, it's called the unity. If I raise that to subsequent powers, 1 to the power 1, 1 to the power 2, 1 to the power 3, modulo P, it's always 1. So 1 has an order of 1. It means that by the time it gets back to itself, it loops around. That happens immediately. If I look at the number 2, let's say that's 2, 2 to the power, so I look at the consecutive numbers 2, 2 to the power 2, 2 to the power 3, etc., right? It's going to jump, modulo P, it's going to jump in some rather random fashion. It's going to the power 2, to the power 3, to the power 4, to the power 5, to the power 6. At some point, it's going to hit itself again. I mean, maybe it exhausts the entire, all of the numbers, all the 2 to the power 1024, roughly, numbers. Before it, you get to some exponent that maps back to itself. Right? So now what we're interested in is numbers that have the property that 2 to the power q minus 1 maps back to itself. It doesn't have to be the number 2. We don't know if that works, but it's some number a. So, in fact, what we're saying is the number at some point, when you keep raising it to consecutive powers, there is a number q, it has to be that q, such that a to the power q happens to be 1. So now, let's say, right, so this is a huge set of numbers, modulo p, as I said. So let's say that it happens to be that this number over there, which let's call it g, not coincidentally, that this number has the property that if I look at g to the power 1, which is g, g to the power 2, etc., all modulo p, right? By the time I hit g to the power q, I'm back I'm basically at 1. Right, so if you look at g to the power q minus 1, that would be its own number, what p again. So therefore, if I do times g, so we're wrapping around. So let me erase this over here. The important part is that consecutive powers of g, maybe it's these numbers here, you know, that is a subset of the entire set of numbers. And it's a subset of order q. So the interesting thing, property of that group, is that any of the numbers in here, and it will include the number 1, I should have said, the unity number. So it will be a number 1 and then a whole bunch of other numbers. Interesting thing is that any of these numbers, A1, A2, etc., that all of these numbers have, other than 1, have the property that if I raise them to the AI, to the power Q, so that they all have order Q. That's basically how we talk about it. So the result is that, it gets a bit technical here, but so that if I look at they're called generators. Each of these numbers, A1, A2, etc., generates that entire subset. If I look at consecutive powers of any of these numbers, A2 to the power 1, A2 to the power 2, A2 to the power 3, all mod P, then they will cycle throughout this subgroup itself. They'll never move outside to another number. It will stay within the group, in the subgroup. So this is what we call a subgroup of order Q. So it's kind of a peculiar property. And so in practice, what we'll do is that we say, you know, our prime P is 1024, But the prime Q, actually, we can take it much smaller. We can take this to be a 160-bit number because we will allow P of a form 2 to the power something times Q minus 1. So that can be a 1024-bit number, but Q can be a 160-bit number. For those familiar with elliptic with standard digital signature algorithm, this is something that's used there as well. So now we get into the U-proof specifics. So the discrete log problem, if you look at generators G, numbers in the subgroup of order Q, we can ask the exact same thing, right? And the discrete log problem remains hard. So I can pick any number in there and any exponent and ask you, if I give you the result, what was the number that I used, and you won't be able to compute that efficiently. Now, so what makes it interesting, and that's why we need the subgroup property, is that for us, the identity provider, so it will say, I'm going to pick a P, I'm going to add of the form 2 to the power something times Q minus 1. Those are part of my system parameters that I'm going to publish that anyone will need to know who wants to verify my signature or my security tokens. In addition, I'm going to not pick just one generator G that has this magical property of having order Q. I'm going to pick a whole bunch of them. Let's call them G1, G2, G3. Now, and it's going to publish these along with its prime P and Q. It's got, these are my system parameters. I'm going to use those whenever I assign security tokens. Now, to encode attributes into a security token that the issuer or the identity provider issues, so let's say attribute value A1, A2, it's going to say, okay, I'm going to compute G1 to the power A1 times G2 to the power A2 times G3 to the something random, let's call it alpha, modulo P. So we get a multi-exponentiation here, and this will stay in that subgroup. It's just another number in the subgroup, but, you know, now, we can actually prove, so let's say this is my gender. It's 0 or 1, male or female. This is my year of birth, so maybe there are 100 possibilities, let's say, or my age, just in years. So let's say here's only 2 possibilities, here's 100 possibilities, but this I pick at random. So, and I'm going to give you the result, mark P. And I say, Vittorio, you know, with the best cryptographic algorithms that are available, can you please compute for me which A1 and A2 I used to compute the output and random number? But I'm not telling them what to you, right? So all you have is the P, the H, and these 3 generators. Now, again, we can prove mathematically that if you can break this problem, you can break the standard discrete log problem. It's equally hard. Now, the other thing, and it's is the property of hash functions, which I said earlier on, once I give you H, I have committed to my attributes A1 and A2. Because if you then say, well, could you please reveal them to me? Now, I'm going to try and lie. I'm going to try and change these values in a way that suits me. So I'm going to have to try and find an A1 star, and a G2 A2 star, and a G3 alpha 2, which maps to the same H. So, and we can mathematically prove that if I am capable of finding a different A1, A2, and a random number that will map to the same H, I can actually break this problem. So, and everybody believes this is an intractable problem. It's like the factoring problem that underpins the RSA algorithm. So this means that, so what the issuer is going to do in the U-proof system, it's going to say, you know, Vittorio, I'm going to issue a token, security token for you. I'm going to digitally sign, you know, I'm going to encode, let's say, your age and your age in number of years and your gender, right? So it's going to sign, as I said, not just A1 and A2, right? That's the conventional approach. It's going to apply this function, and that's what it's going to sign. So actually, this is a random number that is picked by the user. It's part of the user's private key that we talked about earlier on, and only the user will know it. That's kind of magic. The issuer will never see it. If you actually look at how that might be achieved, to give you an idea, so the identity provider will say, okay, I'm going to encode in a security token attributes values A1 and A2, and Vittorio, as a user in our protocol, please provide to me this for a random secret of yours that you're, and again, this is a discrete log problem on its own, right? It's a generator to power something. I, as the issuer, won't be able to figure out your private key. You just give me the image. So, but I can still, as the issuer, so now that I have that, I can multiply these together and say, okay, so that's the number H. I'm going to digitally sign that with the special crypto magic for signing, which I'm not elaborating on at this point. Now, the result is that times G2 to the A2, right, times this number. So this thing is now signed. So what you got from the issuer is its signature on this. This is your private key, which only you know. The issuer didn't even see it. So what it signs is the number H. Now, when you go over there, so you divulge this thing here, with this, the issuer signature on H, right? And so, as mentioned, the verifier, by looking at H and knowing P and G1, 2, 3, it cannot figure out A1 and A2. They're unconditionally hidden. In fact, even if you have infinite computing power, you will not be able to find out the A1 and A2 that the issuer put into the token. Essentially, it's not just computational protection, it's unconditional. Because there are, in fact, a lot of possible different exponent sets that all map to the same H that was digitally signed by the issuer. However, as I said, as a user, I can only know one. I'm committed to it as soon as I give you the H. And in this case, the H is actually digitally signed by the identity provider. So if I would be able to know more than one, I can actually break discrete logarithms. So I can only know one. But there do exist, you know, for every possible A1 and A2, there is exactly one alpha such that this multi-exponentiation product results in the same H. We just cannot compute it because that's very hard. So basically, the issuer's signature on the number H unconditionally hides the actual age and gender that it encoded for you into your token. Now, of course, you want to disclose some or all of the data, right? So again, the simple thing would be, I'm going to disclose all the data, both attribute values, to the relying party, because it needs to know both of them. So you would just disclose A1, A2, and alpha, and then the relying party can check that they map to age. Now, if you only want to disclose A1, right, so you're only going to disclose A1, and you don't want to disclose A2. So what you could do is, so you're going to disclose A1 to the relying party, and you're going to, let me do that in red, and this part there, without opening it up. So you're going to say, here's my A1, and here's this block, G2 to A2, G3 to the alpha, which I'm not opening up. So the relying party can still check, okay, that's the right A1, I multiply everything and it maps to H, but it also wants to have a guarantee that I didn't lie about my A1. So what we need to do is, another notion that happens here is a proof of knowledge, that instead of proving you as the user that, you know, you have to prove that this number here is indeed of the form G2 to the something, G3 to the something, and that you know these two numbers. You don't have to disclose them to the relying party, but you do need to prove that you know them in order to show this is of the right form. So therefore, if I am disclosing A1 to you, I cannot pick, right, because if you think about it, if you, Vittorio, just says, here's my A1, and here's a number B, which you claim is that number there, and the relying party says, okay, now I'm going to compute G1 to the value A1, multiply it by B, and I'm going to check that it maps to H, right, to see if that was really the right A1 value that the issuer encoded. I mean, that would be easy. You could easily lie about it. You could give another number here because you just give another corresponding B over there. So you have to prove that you actually know how to write this as something of this form without disclosing these exponents. That brings us to the notion of proof knowledge that we do in the presentation of the token. How much time have we left?
Well, we've been going for a good 45 minutes.
Okay.
And you succeeded in making me feel way less smart than I normally think of myself. So thank you. But I'd say that we can still go like 10 minutes.
Okay, excellent. Okay, so more generally, right, so what the issuer does when it wants to issue to you any number of attributes, right, so it needs to, let's say it wants to be able to encode 10 different attributes into each security token that it issues. So it's going to say, I'm going to pick a P and a Q of the right form, two large prime numbers. I'm going to pick a bunch of generators. In this case, I'm going to pick 10. As well as a dummy one, G11, in order to be able to encode 10 attribute values into a token. So to issue the token to you, it's going to say, well, I'm going to sign this form as we discussed. These are the 10 different attribute values, or whatever they represent. And then there is this number with a private key that you generate there, right? And it signs that. So let's call that H. So you now have a signature on this blob here. And so when you disclose that to the relying party, H and the signature of the issuer, it doesn't disclose anything about A1 up to A10, other than what you are explicitly going to disclose. So, what we use there to disclose, let's say, A1 and A2, right, as I said, those you just open and say, here are the values, and then for the other stuff, A3 up to the rest, this, it's a blob, but you have to prove that it's of the right form without disclosing these values. So that's where we use a zero-knowledge proof of knowledge, which looks as follows. In the example, does that work?
Yep.
Yep. In the example, to prove that this blob B here, right, I'm going to have to prove that B is of the form G3 to the A3 up to G10 to the A10 times G11 to my random number alpha. I'm the user without disclosing it. Relying party wants to know that I know those exponents, a set of exponents that matches that, in order to have confidence that A1 and A2 were indeed as encoded by the relying by the issuer. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to send a number, A, which has the exact same form, but with random numbers up there that I pick purely at random at presentation time, G10 to the W10 times G11 to the some other random number, beta. The relying party is going to issue me a challenge, a random number, a nonce.
I'm starting to see. Oh, fantastic. This is very clever.
Thank you. Yeah. So this is actually the exact same nonce or challenge that I talked about earlier about a proof of knowledge of the private key. It's just that instead of proving I know a private key to the relying party alpha without disclosing it to prevent replay, I'm proving more. I'm proving I know also the other attribute values that I'm not disclosing to you because I don't want you to know them. I want them to be unconditionally hidden. So basically what you do, and this is crypto math, is that then upon a computer response, which has the form response, well, you know, matching to this, I'm going to take challenge times my attribute value that I'm hiding plus the random value there. I'm going to do the exact same for all the other exponents. So I'm basically showing you a linear relation between each of these. So I'm going to give you a bunch of challenge responses, C times R10 plus W10. And R11 equals challenge times the random number plus the one-time random number. sounds like a mystery. So the neat thing is that the relying party is able to check, because this was unpredictable to me when I sent this one-time random blob. I can only compute these responses if I actually know those exponents. And the verifier, the relying party can actually check that without knowing the actual exponents, because it can, if you look at the math, it can say, well, G3 to the R3, dot, 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 times G10 to the R10, G11 to the R11, is that equal to this number B to the power C times A? So if and only if that verification holds, then I must have constructed these numbers in this form, knowing the exponents. And yet you don't learn as a relying party anything about them. But so this is a proof of the user to the relying party that the opened up values A1 and A2 are correct. I'm not able to lie about it. And I'm proving that by proving you that I know the other ones. And if you think about it, as I said, for the user it's not possible to know two different exponent tuples that match to the same number H. Right, so by me proving to you that I know A3 up to A10 and alpha without disclosing them, it's still, I mean, I know them and I know these because I've disclosed them to you, and I can only know one. So, right, if I would be able to give you two wrong values here, then I would need to, in order to do this proof of knowledge, I would actually need to know another A3 up to A10 and another alpha, which would mean I know two entirely different exponent sets, which we just said is impossible because it means I can break discrete logs.
Yeah.
So this is a proof that the attribute values that I am disclosing are correct and the others are unconditionally hidden. So this is what we have in our toolkit, in our crypto spec, that any subset can be disclosed. Now, I have 5 minutes?
You have 4 minutes.
4 minutes, okay. So let's get quickly back to how that matches to this. I already said on-demand tokens. We can do long-lived tokens. In fact, because the alpha here is the private key of the user, that the user would never divulge. It's not an attribute. It's a number that the user picks. Even the issuer never sees it, the identity provider. So that's where we get the prevention against replay. And there's some other things that are a bit more technical, possible security threats. If you look at transferability, it's actually quite neat that this selective disclosure technique, where the user can disclose only some of the encoded attribute data, that we can use it to strengthen, the issuer can exploit that, to strengthen its protection against the user transferring a copy of his token to his neighbor. Namely, imagine that A10, for example, that the issuer says, I'm going to encode as A10, you as the user Vittorio, I'm going to encode a password of yours, or a private key, or something else that's confidential to you. Now, if you, Vittorio, whenever you use this token, you would never disclose that. We call it a lending disincentive. It's your confidential data. So, and it remains unconditionally hidden through the technique here, so you would only disclose some or all of the other attributes as needed and as you're comfortable with. However, as we also saw, in order for you to do this proof of knowledge here, when you present the token, you do need to know all of them. So if you want to give me a copy of your security token, you do have to give me all of these values. I'm your neighbor, and I want to use your token. Maybe it's access to paid TV channels, right? So you have to give me your confidential data, which you'd rather not do. So this is a software-only technique to discourage the user from giving copies of his tokens, to long-lived tokens, to other people. Device-protected tokens, very briefly, what we can now do, and this is really neat, is that, so here you are as the user, with your desktop or mobile phone or what have you. If I'm the issuer, the identity provider, and I want to make sure that you cannot use your tokens that are issued without the approval or collaboration of a smart card or trusted platform module, let's say it's a TPM.
Yeah.
So let's say that A1, G1 to the A1, that A1 is a secret key of the TPM. It's a random number, it's a private key, in the same way as that is your random number, alpha. This is the random number of the TPM. the issuer can say, well, A2 up to A10 are meaningful data, like your age, your name, your gender, and whatever else our underlying party might want to know. But before I sign this whole blurb, I'm going to multiply in G1 to the A1 for the particular TPM that I want to bind the security token to. Now, the result is that when you get that security token, notice that to issue that device TPM protected token to the user, the issuer doesn't need to communicate with the TPM. It can still issue it to your device. It's not involved. It just needs to multiply it in. So you still store the entire token, but now you don't know this thing here. So you're stuck when you want to present the token, because you need to do the challenge response and prove whatever you disclose here. You don't know this number, so you cannot do this challenge response. So you need the collaboration of the TPM in order to present, the, complete the challenge response. So the challenge goes over there. You're like, gee, you know, I need to compute all of these responses here. But I can't. Like in particular R3, let's say, or actually R1 in this example, I can't compute it because I don't have that secret key of the TPM. So this one, you would just forward the challenge to the TPM, and it's going to compute that one and give it to you. These you compute yourself, and so you bundle them up and you send the whole thing off. Underlying party is happy because it gave the right. But if the TPM says, wait a minute, Vittorio, you're trying to present this token to a relying party that you're not allowed to present it to, I'm not going to give you my response. Or, you know, before I give you my response, please put your finger on my fingerprint scanner so I know it's you. Or, you know, hey, you've used the same token 20 times at different places, and it's a 20 used token. So I'm not going to give you the response for the 21st opportunity you want to present it. So we can do device protected tokens, where any identity provider can issue security tokens that piggyback on the security of a hardware device, a TPM or what have you, and it can enforce dynamically any use constraints that you can imagine, such as don't use tokens beyond an expiry date, don't use them outside of the country.
That's really great. That's fascinating. You wanna, I'd say, went in the rooms of my brain that had the light off for the last 10 years. It actually reminded me of my vector algebra times. let's say I was younger, so it was nicer. But thank you. Thank you for this very thorough explanation, during which we have seen that it's not magic, but just very, very, very clever cryptography. And as you said at the beginning, I'm not sure if everybody followed, but for the ones that did it, I'm sure it was a feast. It was literally since the very first day that I heard about your proof, that I wanted to know how it works. Well, you know what? Now I know. In 5 minutes, I forget because it's just too much to keep all in the brain. But I'm sure that a lot of people won't, and they will actually use the protocol with a new confidence.
And there is actually, for those who are really interested in this, there is a book that was published by the MIT Press in 2000 that is my dissertation, actually, that describes all of the cryptography in gory detail, and it also shows you how to do the other 18 or 16 features that I haven't been able to get to.
That's great. Thank you. We'll make sure that we add it to the...
And that's a free download, that book. I'm not pitching anything commercial here.
That's great. So we'll add the link to the description. So thank you again for giving us such a nice explanation, and I'm hoping that I will manage to feature you again early in our show.
Likewise. Thanks for the opportunity.
Thank you.